Welcome to Chain Reaction, the Foreign Policy Research Institute's flagship network of podcast series examining the political, security, economic, and social trends shaping Europe and Eurasia. Throughout the year, we're talking with experts about developments in Russia's war in Ukraine, the new European security order, the past, present, and future of the Baltic states, Russia's political economy, and great power competition in the region. Join us each month for
Bear Market Brief,
Baltic Ways,
Report in Short,
and of course, our flagship Chain Reaction. New episodes are available each week on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. This week on the Bear Market Brief.
In case you weren't in the loop, it's election season in Russia. There is a presidential election going on, and here's the rub. We already know who's going to win. And I don't mean polls are pointing a certain direction. I mean, we literally know that Vladimir Putin will be re-elected president. Welcome back to the Bear Market Brief podcast. I'm your host, Aaron Schwartzbaum. So yeah, we have an election with a more or less preordained outcome that raises the somewhat obvious question, well, if we already know what's going to happen in the election, why bother having the election to begin with? This episode, we'll be trying to answer that question. We'll be diving into the nuances of a political system often referred to as an electoral autocracy, and more. So stay tuned. We have two guests dropping by to help me understand these issues. First up is Olga Khvostunova. She is a fellow at FPRI's Eurasia program and a PhD student at Stony Brook University's Political Science Department. Previously, she worked as a journalist at the Kommersant newspaper in Moscow and later as an editor and political analyst at the Institute of Modern Russia in New York and Free Russia Foundation in Washington, D.C. Second, but nonetheless, is a name and voice you've heard before, Andras Tortsifra. Andras is a political and risk analyst based in New York City and a fellow here at the FPRI Eurasia program. He's also a contributing author for the Bear Market Brief newsletter, which, by the way, you should sign up for. Beyond a series of impressive fellowships, he has also been working in the private sector as an analyst and consultant focused on security and cybersecurity issues related to Europe and Russia. He specializes in Russian and Eastern European politics and regularly publishes for Riddle Russia, the Moscow Times, as well as his analytical blog, No Yardstick. So then, let's begin. Olga and Andras, welcome to the Bear Market Brief. Let's start with some quick introductions. Olga, we'll kick it to you to get us started today.
Thank you for having me. So I'm a Russian journalist. I worked with the Russian opposition for a while. I'm currently Eurasia Fellow at FPRI. And also I'm doing a PhD in political science at Stony Brook University.
And Andras, over to you.
Thank you for having me. I am Andras Tortsifra, originally from Hungary, political and security risk analyst. I am also a Eurasia Fellow with FPRI, contributor to the Bear Market Brief and analyst of Russian domestic politics.
Fantastic. Well, we've got quite a lineup for you listeners today, and we're going to be talking about Russia's election happening this week. We are recording this on March 13th, so this may come out after the election, just so you have that frame of reference. So, I mean, the joke question here is who's going to win, but the funny part, and maybe not so funny part, is that we already know. But I want to pretend for a second that this is a competitive race. I want to talk about who else other than Putin is even running, what differentiates them, what segments of the electorate they're trying to capture, or whose, in practice, anger are they trying to diffuse. So we'll start with Andras on this one. Who's even in the race?
So there are three other candidates apart from Putin. And I think we are also going to maybe briefly talk about who's not running or who was going to be running but isn't running. But first, the ones who are running. So in a way, if you look at their party affiliation, they are the usual suspects. The so-called systemic opposition, the opposition that is represented in the Duma, and that is, you know, largely loyal to the system itself. So from the Communist Party, we have Nikolai Kharitonov. He's a veteran member of the Duma, the chairman of the Committee on the Development of the Far East and the Arctic. He had already run once against Putin in 2004, but currently he is just a stand-in for, well, Gennady Zyuganov, who is normally running from the Communist Party or has been the token candidate from the Communists over the over most of the presidential races, other than not in 2018. And he's a relatively known, but not very well known, and certainly not very inspiring politician from the communists. From the Liberal Democratic Party, which we always need to add is not neither liberal nor really democratic, and very much aligned with positions of Vladimir Putin, we have Leonid Slutsky, who is the head of the party after the death in 2022 of Vladimir Zhirinovsky, the longtime head of the party, definitely much, much less colorful and charismatic than the previous leader. And he has also faced sexual misconduct allegations. Before that, he was a member of the Parliamentary Assembly of the Council of Europe on behalf of Russia. And as such, he played an important role in building bridges between Russia and the European far right. He is a fantastically non-charismatic party apparatchik in the Liberal Democratic Party, and as such is very unlikely to have the appeal of his predecessor in this position. And then we have Vladislav Davankov, who is running from the New People Party. The New People Party was a party that was created a couple of years ago and was allowed to run and enter the State Duma as a liberal alternative, or a more liberal alternative than any of the other parties, to United Russia, the governing party. And Davankov is the deputy head of the Duma. He also ran for Moscow mayor last year, finished with about 5% of the votes, according to the official count. He has been the right-hand man of Alexei Nechayev, the businessman who is the founder of the New People Party. And this party more or less focuses, or has been focusing on issues such as the regional agenda, economic modernization, while also having fairly conservative positions on a lot of social issues. And yet, it has been the party has been regarded as a kind of liberal alternative. Davankov himself supported the anti-war candidate Boris Nadezhdin, who was allowed to collect signatures but then was disqualified from the race, perhaps in a hope to attract some of Nadezhdin's electorate or some of Nadezhdin's supporters to his side. After the inevitable disqualification of the candidate himself, which, as we know, did happen. And there is indeed a dispute going on in the liberal Russian opposition about whether it is okay or it is advisable to vote for Davankov, who is very much a systemic candidate, even though he is probably, as of now, of the four people running, the closest to liberal opposition.
So Olga, kicking it over to you, I guess one of my questions is, we've seen a very quite firm closing of the political arena and the space for actual discussion and debate. So have you seen these parties or candidates like meaningfully differentiate themselves? They can't criticize the war. What amount of discussion or debate is even allowed within this current electoral framework?
Well, it's a great question, because it kind of precludes from the discussion the fact that so many repressive laws in Russia actually prevent you from saying what you really think about the war. There is the so-called party line, which means repeating what Putin or the administration, the presidential administration, is saying about the war. So there is an official narrative and you have to stick to it. I found this analysis by one of the Yabloko party members, and Yabloko is the actual liberal party that still exists in Russia, except that it has been marginalized to the point that I think only few members of the party are actually elected in the region, but it's not represented in the Duma. So they conducted this analysis and they identified all the key legislations over the last 2 years that had to do with the war or any other proposals coming out of sort of the presidential administration. And all these candidates, Kharitonov, Slutsky, and Davankov, they all voted the same. So there is no differentiation between them. The only sort of reason they are running is because it doesn't look good if Putin runs by himself, right? So he needs to have this backup dancers, I guess. And against those people, he has to look as the best. And that has been the setup for since, I guess, 2004, since Putin was running for the second term. So there's always Putin, who has been always portrayed as the only competent, smart, knowledgeable candidate, and the rest of them are sort of a joke. However, there are some people who maybe are buying, even inside Russia, are buying that Russia is still a democracy, so there has to be several candidates. And each of these candidates is trying to absorb a little portion of ideological pie that exists in Russia. So, for example, communists do have ideological support. They do have, on average, 10 to 17% of the vote. So if you look at all the presidential elections over the last 25 years, a candidate from the Communist Party tends to come the second in the election. And I think Kharitonov, who is actually running the second time, the first time he was running in 2004, I think he gained around 10% of the vote. And then the third is usually the Liberal Democratic Party, which is, it sounds misleading, but it's more of a nationalist party. And it was a personalist party of the former leader, Vladimir Zhirinovsky, who was this super charismatic, but also very controversial politician. So his party also tends to collect votes of the people who actually support what the party is doing or proposing. So that kind of gives people, I guess, a superficial sense of validation. They have someone who's running on their behalf. They can vote for them. But at the end of the day, they do know that Putin will win. And then the third one, this sort of more an artificial construct, because the actual liberal opposition has been marginalized and sort of purged from the public discourse or political space. But there has to be another sort of outlet to siphon these grievances that people have. And even though their preferred candidates are not available on the ballot, there is some sort of, you know, substitution that they can, okay, well, out of four, I can vote for Dvankov because he's sort of representing. So this is an artificial choice, but in an autocracy, it's essentially meaningless. And one thing I wanted to say that goes to why this is important and what kind of results we're looking, we know that Putin is going to win because this is a largely orchestrated election. But the only thing I think the presidential administration, which is the governmental body that actually runs the election and is sort of monitoring how things are done, the point that I have heard that they're trying to achieve is for Putin to gain 60 million votes in this election. This means that, so in 2020, when people were voting on the new Russian constitution, there was sort of a confidence vote for Putin's policies. And that was around 57 million of votes. So after that, Putin started the war, right? So now they got maybe like 3 million more people with the new territories. Accounting for that, what Putin wants from this election is another confidence vote. That's the whole purpose of this. Reelecting is not important. The percentage of the vote is not that important. But the absolute number for Putin to know that he has all these people supporting him is what he will go out to the world and say, look, they're still with me. They support the war. They supported the constitution. They love me. I'm a democratically elected leader. So there you go.
Adash, over to you for kind of a question about the campaign rhetoric, insofar as there really is a campaign versus a concerted effort just to turn people out, as Olga was just talking about. Is the war actually being mentioned? I remember back in 2004 for our election here in the States as a kid, that was kind of a point of contention. We were saying we should fight the war in Iraq or we shouldn't fight the war. Is this even being discussed?
I would say it's impossible not to have the war as at least as a background, but it is used by the presidential administration to give a to give exactly that, just the background against which the presidential election needs to be seen, and not as something that is happening to Russians that negatively influences their standards of living, their financial possibilities, opportunities, their lives. Even one of the big themes that the presidential administration certainly tried to avoid, and I think they mostly avoided it, mentioning in the campaign or being mentioned or being discussed, is the second potential second round of military mobilization, which is something that Russians are probably, based on their reactions to the first round of military mobilization in September 2022, and from the public discourse that has either, you know, like semi-publicly or not, like, that is not in the not in the Russian mainstream media, but in social media, has been happening around that, are concerned about and afraid of. They more or less avoided the discussion about the second round of mobilization, and I think that was the most important topic to avoid for the Kremlin as regards to war. In the so-called presidential debates that took place before the election, where either Putin obviously didn't participate in these, but the other candidates and their surrogates did, the war itself as a policy was not challenged. They did not talk about these things. They talked about the education, they talked about economic development and so on. And because there is really not much to talk to speak about the war. The only context in which the war was raised during the campaign was the collection of signatures for in support of Boris Nadezhdin, the so-called anti-war candidate, also a long-term politician from, I'd say, the second rank of Russian opposition, who collected the necessary number of signatures and whose signature collection was, for a couple of weeks, a low-cost, low-risk form of anti-war activism for Russians who were so inclined, but who was then not allowed to run, who was then disqualified because the Central Electoral Committee said that too many of the signatures were forged, whether or not this was so, of course, we will probably never know. But he was predictably disqualified. Perhaps the reason why he was not disqualified earlier was exactly that the Kremlin is very keen on putting out feelers and measuring up the size of the crowd that can be motivated, even to this extent, even to this very small extent, by an anti-war message. And but it was not interested in actually discussing the war as a policy in the context of the campaign.
Yeah, these trial balloons, remembering, you know, my time in the fields, have been a pretty important part. Turning, I guess, related to trial balloons, but more about policy itself and levers of power. So, Olga, you said Putin has this goal of turning out 60 million people to vote for him. I know there's a couple of levers that the authorities have used to gin up turnout. What inducements have been offered? Russia typically is very hawkish with policy, except for right before elections. So has there been like populist policy floated? How does the administration hope to get people out to the polls this time around?
So I think the main technique has been the same over, I think, about a century since Russia has become the Soviet Union. And that is using your employment or your employer, especially if the employer is somehow affiliated or impacted by the state. And the state in Russia is so strong that, you know, basically every employer has certain connections to the Russian authorities on a certain level. So trying to use the employers, and I think around 40% of the Russian labor force is directly employed by a different state or state-like structures. So that's pretty much a huge leverage that you can use to basically ask the employer to force people to go out and vote. And that's been the incentive that has been used, like I said, in the Soviet Union. And it's being just as seamlessly used in Russia right now. I think some of the sort of ridiculous requirements would have you go to the voting station and take a picture of who you voted for. So that would ensure that you voted for the correct candidate. So for that, you sort of might get some sort of leeway at your working place. Not everyone finds this nice, but people have been used to it or exposed to it for a while. And also there are some minor sanctions that can be used against people who refuse to do that. So more or less, people try to just meet this requirement, get it over with, because they don't quite consider elections, as they did in the Soviet Union again, as an important tool. They want to have this opportunity to sort of show that they have a choice to either participate or not participate. But Russia has never been a democracy in the sense that people have developed a sense of why the elections are important. So yeah, you can just use the employer and get it over with.
I'd also note that Russia has a very unique multi-day election system. I just want to talk about that just for 1 second, about the introduction of that. That didn't used to be the case, now it is. So why is that the case?
Well, multi-day voting was introduced during COVID and ostensibly to sort of, you know, draw out voting to prevent overcrowding of polling stations, but it was also from the get-go a means to allow the authorities to more efficiently engineer the vote. So 3-day voting usually, like, it has become very common for the state owned companies to tell their employees, or the state institutions to tell their employees to vote on the first day, so that if further adjustments are needed, the authorities can know it as early as possible, and they can, in various ways, adjust the turnout upwards. And it also means that observers have a more difficult time monitoring the vote, because you know, the ballots are stored in the polling stations overnight, and they also need to divide their attention on a polling station across 3 days. But this is just one of the many innovations that have been introduced in recent years, the other being online voting, which is another powerful tool that was first introduced in 2019 and has since been expanded to several regions. It was originally introduced in Moscow, which to this day uses a different system, but the rest of the regions, voters log in through Gasuslugi, which is the government services portal, and they have to pre-register for using online voting. Not in Moscow, again, I mean, Moscow, you can just turn up and put in your credentials in Moscow government services portal and vote, but in the other regions, you have to pre-register, and this is, again, promoted very heavily by local authorities. Why? Because online voting allows the authorities to implement the same electoral manipulation techniques that they had done in offline voting, but with more efficiency, because you need less people to oversee the manipulations. For instance, you know, you don't have to actually stuff ballots into voting bins, because it all happens electronically. It was also a very opaque system, difficult for observers to access. It puts a burden of intimidation on the voter, so to say, because you log in with your credentials. You can never know, because of the opacity of the system, whether your vote will not be tied to your name. It is easier to get your employees to register for online voting, because they don't physically have to go somewhere. It literally takes just a couple of minutes to register and then to vote. So it just makes everything more efficient. Even there have been cases over the past couple of years when people seem to have been registered to vote against their will, or without them explicitly wanting to register. So it's also a good way to increase turnout this way. And observers have noted over the past couple of years that online votes have skewed very strongly towards pro-regime candidates. So United Russia candidates in regional and the Duma election. And it is probably going to be the case in this presidential election, although we will have to see this, but it is very likely that they are going to skew towards Vladimir Putin. this is not a kill switch. You can't just decide it. You can't just get to 60 million votes that Olga has mentioned by online voting, because there are simply not enough people to vote online. There are online voting is in Moscow in 26 regions plus the occupied Crimea. And those regions have, I think, 48 million voters between themselves. And only about 10, 12 million of those are likely to vote online based on registration rates. So what it can do, on the other hand, is many of these regions are problematic from the point of view of the Kremlin, in as much as they are more inclined to support opposition candidates, or they have had over the past couple of years grassroots movements, grassroots opposition movements, successful ones, or they encompass some of the largest cities in Russia, apart from Moscow. But as I mentioned, also Moscow has online voting. So the purpose and the potential use of this is to just ring out a couple of persons here and there, and it will add up.
Very innovative. When Andras before said innovation, I made air quotes just for the record to listeners. You'll see, and we've seen before, some really wacky statistics that usually come out after the elections, things like a correlation between the turnout rate and support for the regime candidates, which if you think about it, it shouldn't really matter that much. It should be the same pattern of voting no matter how many people turn out. But yeah, there's more regime support when more people vote, which doesn't really seem like very human behavior. But we're not talking about statistical fraud detection in this podcast. One last question for Olga here, and then we'll turn over to our word of the day. But I think we can't not mention the fate of Alexei Navalny, who died recently. Murdered may be a word some would want to use. But with his death, where do we find the non-systemic opposition, the opposition? Are they a meaningful force at all anymore?
It's a great question, and something a lot of people are thinking about, people who care about, liberal democracy for Russia, or democracy in general for Russia. So since the war started, a lot of these people had to flee the country. And even before that, any dissident type of groups were basically squeezed out of Russia and forced to go into exile. The problem of the Russian opposition, even before it was marginalized and sort of put into non-systemic state, was that it has been divided. So I guess if you make a total number of people who maybe voted for a democratic candidate, this could be a significant number. So for example, in a year 2004, when Putin was already in power and has established certain safeguard mechanisms, the democratic candidate, Grigory Yavlinsky, who used to be the chairman of the Yabloko party, I mentioned previously, the liberal party, he came in third after the communist, and he collected around, I think, 10% of the vote, even though he was already sort of put on the margins in terms of public access to the media and sort of ability to influence public opinion. And also one can say that in the 90s, democratic candidates were able to win the Russian votes. So I would say there is still a significant portion of the population who would vote if people got together and produced a unified candidate that could be a figure of compromise for a lot of people. In my opinion, Boris Nemtsov, who was killed in 2015, had the biggest potential for to be such a figure because of his charisma, because of his previous government experience, because of his views. And he was able to talk to people the same way sort of Alexei Navalny was able to talk to. So kind of like a level with the person he was talking to without being a snob or, like a politician. So after Navalny was, let's say, murdered, because I tend to side with that definition, the Russian opposition is sort of left even in a more miserable state than it had been previously. Some hope can be taken from the fact that his wife, Yulia Navalny, stepped up to take over the organization he created, the Anti-Corruption Foundation. Some people view her as another potential figure who could unify different forces in the Russian opposition, but it will take a lot of work. And another problematic thing is that because of many of these opposition groups operate outside of Russia, it's really difficult for them to appear as legitimate forces inside Russia. The longer they stay outside, the less legitimacy they retain within the Russian Federation. So, I mean, I don't want to say it's hopeless, but it will be really difficult for a really long time.
There was a cartoon I just saw with the forces of the opposition besieging the Kremlin, and they're climbing up ladders to get Putin and whacking each other with their swords and hammers as they try to climb up the ladders, and Putin and the gang are looking on confused. Why are they fighting each other? Last question, we'll stay with Olga for this, but you know, before I'm a political economist, I am a total language nerd, and I always try to feature a term of the day on these podcasts. So Olga, you had one, a Russian term. What did you bring for us today?
So the word, or rather an expression I'm bringing for this podcast is электоральное мероприятие, which is electoral event. And this is the term that sort of Russia hands and Russian observers and Russian experts have been using to describe an election in Russia. And the irony here is that you sort of highlight the fact that it has something to do with elections by pointing out that it's electoral, but it's not really an election per se, it's an event. So therefore, there will be sort of some actions pertaining to electoral procedure. For example, there will be a voting station, there will be a ballot, there will be technically a few candidates on the ballot, but essentially this is not an election, that this is just profanation of sorts, I think. And that's, I feel like, there is a lot of irony in this term, and you know, that's why people use it.
Olga and Andras, thank you for coming by the Bear Market Brief. Thanks again to our guests, Olga and Andras, and to you, listener, for joining for this episode. I certainly learned a lot, and I hope you learned something too. We've got more episodes in the works, so stay tuned. Be sure to follow the Bear Market Brief on the platform formerly known as Twitter at the handle @BearMarketBrief. The Bear Market Brief is brought to you by the Foreign Policy Research Institute, that's FPRI, a nonpartisan think tank based in Philadelphia. For more information on this initiative and on many others, be sure to visit fpri.org. We'll catch you next time.